The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hello. In our last look at the Hogarth Press, we heard about the origins of the press, including the somewhat impulsive purchase for £19 by a married couple in their 30s at the time, Virginia Woolf and her husband, Leonard. We heard how they set up the press in their dining room and got to work cranking out copies. Their first effort, two stories, one by each of them, was 32 pages long, and it took them 2.5 months to produce 150 copies. The experience was not lucrative, not at first, but it was diverting enough for them to continue. And we know the end of the story, which is that the Hogarth Press became one of the most important publishers of the 20th century. And the name continues today. Today, we'll hear about their first real success, which came with another story by Virginia Woolf. We'll hear that story, and then we'll hear what ultimately happened to the Woolfs and their hobby/business. That's coming up today on The History of Literature. Okay, here we go. Welcome to the podcast, everyone, and happy August. I'm Jack Wilson, watching Wong Kar-wai films again. My goodness, what a filmmaker. The story I heard is that Quentin Tarantino was watching Chungking Express and he just started crying, not because the story was sad, but because he loved the film so much, the techniques in it, the love of filmmaking it exuded, the reminder of what good filmmaking can do and where it can go. Is In the Mood for Love, what a masterpiece. And yet I wouldn't dare to show it to my kids. They would not like it, I'm quite sure. It's a bit like Chekhov. You probably have to be a bit older to truly love it. Or maybe a very particular kind of young person. Anyway, highly recommended, Wong Kar-wai. It makes me wonder if we should do a few more films here on the history of literature. It's so important for storytelling here in the 20th and 21st centuries. Maybe we'll do that in 2023. Do one a month or so. Give us some fresh new material. Speaking of which, Virginia Woolf is one of those authors we've sort of circled around as we look for fresh new material. We're always looking at aspects of her work and life here and there, not taking her on directly with an episode just devoted to her life and works. We've done the same thing with Jane Austen and Chekhov. Sometimes these authors are so important to me, I can only get one. Shakespeare's another one. I can't really start at the birth and Kafka. That's another one. I can't really start at their birth and go to the end. I can't just march through the life that way. I mean, it could be done. Maybe I will someday, but maybe I won't. Maybe that's not for me. I want to spend so much time on one book or one play or one letter or one aspect of that writer's life that I can't imagine doing an entire episode and leaving things there. Instead, Oscar Wilde is one who's kind of turned out this way. I wouldn't have thought that necessarily for him, but we've had so many guests who have wanted to talk about Oscar Wilde that we've come at him through different angles. One guest talks about Oscar Wilde in prison. Another one talks about Oscar Wilde as a young man and so on. And in the end, we stitch things together, hopefully. The good news is that we get lots of episodes on those authors instead of just one. Speaking of stitching, oh wait, there's one more thing I wanted to tell you. I was doing some Googling to check a few facts about the Woolfs and the Hogarth Press and the dates they bought the thing and so on, and I ran across this feature, People Also Ask, that Google presents on the page along with the search results. Often, these questions are very helpful. They ask the question I myself was trying to ask in my clunky way. Like I type in porch busted winter storm and I get People also ask, how do I repair my crumbling porch? Which is very close to my actual question, which is basically those seven words plus a bunch of seven-letter words interspersed, or to be clear, one particular seven-letter word employed two or three times for mental emphasis as I contemplate my busted porch. So, anyway, this Google feature gives me an easy way to check my answer. And sometimes the question makes me stare in wonder, as it did in this case. First question that showed up for me, people also ask, what was Virginia Woolf known for? Okay, I can imagine that question being asked many, many times, as it must be in order to make its way into Google's searching results. That question could be asked by a student, perhaps, or someone who hasn't yet encountered the actual works of the great writer. The next question is the one that stopped me. The number two question on the list. I mean, it must be asked fairly often. And the question was Virginia Woolf a real person? Yes, Santa Claus, there is a Virginia. Why would that be asked? Is anyone asking, was Charles Dickens a real person or was Gertrude Stein a real person? I don't think so. So why is there incredulity or at least doubt or uncertainty that's making its way, that's being fed into the Google machine? I can only think of a couple of reasons. One might be the play, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? If you're encountering that play, maybe if you're a student, asked to read it and write about it, and you're doing a little research before you do that, you might not know for sure. Playwrights certainly invent names. And the other reason I can think of is that Virginia Woolf just sounds like an invented name. She was born Virginia Stephen, or I guess Adeline Virginia Stephen. And she took the name Woolf when she married Leonard Woolf in 1912 when she was 30. They had met 8 years before at a dinner, and his recollection later was that during the dinner she said nothing and looked ill. Not such an auspicious beginning. He proposed in 1909 and received no answer. He proposed again in 1912, right around her 30th birthday in January, and she asked for some time to consider. He had the complicating factor of working in Ceylon at the time. He was scheduled to leave again. So he asked the civil service, his bosses there, for some time off, and they refused, and so he resigned because Leonard was in love. He was not a great prospect in some ways. Virginia called him a penniless Jew. But he was part of their circle. He was intelligent and thoughtful. He cared deeply for her. She turned him down, finally, on May 1st. But then she reconsidered and told him at the end of that month that she indeed wanted to marry him. They got married 2.5 months later at the registrar's office. She attempted suicide a year later, with subsequent attempts to follow. In spite of her struggles with mental health, the hairy black devils that haunted her, as she called them, she appreciated the marriage. It seems again and again, Leonard did things to try to help her, to try to help her mental stability as best as they could figure out, given their knowledge and the medical resources of the time. 25 years after they were married, she wrote in her diary, quote, "Lovemaking after 25 years can't bear to be separate. You see, it is enormous pleasure being wanted, a wife, and our marriage so complete," end quote. Which was not to say she was always happily married, but perhaps that's a topic for another show. The couple had no children, but they had her books, a different type of progeny, and they had their press. Eventually, they moved houses, and the press migrated from their dining room table to the basement. When we left our budding young publishers last time, they had just produced 150 copies of a book, their first book, which was titled Two Stories. First story, Three Jews by Leonard Woolf to start things off, and then The Mark on the Wall by Virginia Woolf to close things out. Everything was done by the two of them then, other than four woodcut illustrations that they commissioned from a British artist named Dora Carrington, But as the press grew, they did start to engage assistants and managers. They still ran the press itself out of the basement, as I mentioned, but others helped them transform from the vanity press that started things off to a full-blown, commercially successful press. Leonard published his Stories of the East based on some experiences he had while working in the Ceylon Civil Service, a topic he'd previously written about in his novel, The Village in the Jungle, which was not a Hogarth title. It came out years before they bought the press. The Hogarth Press sold books by subscription in the early years, and they had a list of two kinds of subscribers. Those who could be contacted to ask if they wanted to buy this book or that, the latest one, and those who had signed up to buy copies of whatever the press published. Within a few years, though, they would change that business model and start selling their books not directly to consumers who had subscribed, but to booksellers. It helped that they had gotten better at what they were doing. Two Stories was still the work of some amateurs, some novices, a pair of novices. There were some blottings of the ink and some irregular spacing and so on. The effect of owning the press and being a publisher on Virginia as a writer was, I think, twofold. First, laying out the type changed the way she thought of words. It made them more tangible in a sense. It gave her a greater sense of word choice and spacing and so on. It was also freeing to her mind. That's probably the more important effect. She would not have an editor, a male editor, no doubt, second guessing her choices or making suggestions or asking her to change things. With some writers, you might say, well, the right editor could help, just like sometimes it's not good to give a musician unlimited time in the studio or a filmmaker free rein to do whatever he or she wants. Sometimes a wise, intelligent opinion can be useful. And maybe that's true much or most of the time, and maybe it even would have been true for Virginia Woolf, too. It's hard to know for sure. But we know that what she did, knowing that the press was hers and her decision alone, we have those results, and it's hard not to think that it was almost certainly for the best that she had that freedom. She was pushing in new directions. That was her mode and motivation as an artist, and it would have been defeating, I think it's safe to say, to have someone knocking the wind out of those sails. Nobody wants a limp-sailed Virginia Woolf. We want her to ride the wind in all its fast and furious glory. Because what happens when you have an editor and you hear the criticism over and over, you hear the objections, you argue, you start to self-edit. Virginia Woolf was someone who we did not need extra constrictions around her. We want her mind to be free to roam, to move. Okay, we heard that a little bit in the last story, didn't we? Very first self-published story, Mark on the Wall. Mind was free. Okay, so for the first few years, the Hogarth Press was bouncing forward, selling copies in the dozens, maybe the low three figures, getting better at their craft. They managed just that one title, Two Stories, in 1917. Two more in 1918, including a modernist short story by Catherine Mansfield. The story is called Prelude, although the Woolfs mistakenly printed the Prelude at the top of several of the story's pages. They're still somewhat amateurish in their presentation. Mansfield and Woolf were sort of rivals. They showed some jealousy toward one another at times. They felt competitive with one another, but I like to focus on the deep regard that the two had toward one another. They were friends and they were women writing in a man's world, and they were pioneers as artists, too. Mansfield wrote Woolf a letter that said, quote, "You are the only woman with whom I long to talk work. There will never be another," end quote. And Virginia had this to say in private. To her diary, she confided, quote, "To no one else can I talk in the same disembodied way about writing, without altering my thought more than I alter it in writing here," end quote. And let's be honest, if you're putting out a 32-page book that takes you 2.5 months to print, page by painstaking page, you're probably not going to waste one of your two annual publications on a story that you don't like by an author you hate. In 1919, they came out with five publications, including some poems by T.S. Eliot, though not The Wasteland yet. That wouldn't appear until 1922. The Eliot poems of 1919 didn't break through with real success. For that, we look to a different title, Kew Gardens by Virginia Woolf. This time, the woodcut designs were by Vanessa Bell, Virginia's older sister. The Woolfs used wallpaper for the cover, and they referred to themselves by their last name and their first initials. Oddly, L and V Woolf wasn't printed originally. They originally said Virginia and Leonard Woolf, but they printed L and V Woolf on a scrap of paper and pasted it over the original text, somewhat awkwardly. In my opinion, I've read speculation by the folks at the British Library that this may have been done in the hopes of appearing more professional, L and V Woolf seeming more professional than Leonard and Virginia Woolf, but that's hard to believe since it looks kind of amateurish to paste it in like that. In any case, the story, Kew Gardens, is much stronger than the mark on the wall. In fact, it became one of Virginia Woolf's best-known stories. Let's take a break, hear the story that changed their fortune, and then return to talk about what happened to the Hogarth Press afterwards. As you listen to this story, Kew Gardens, have a little patience. You are hearing modernism hatch open like an egg. It's not quite a chicken, but it's getting close. It's out of its shell, gazing around, about to peep. The full stream of consciousness style is not quite there, but we're getting close. We are drifting toward it. Kew Gardens, after this. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself, and it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Kew Gardens by Virginia Woolf. From the oval-shaped flowerbed, there rose perhaps 100 stalks, spreading into heart-shaped or tongue-shaped leaves halfway up, and unfurling at the tip red or blue or yellow petals marked with spots of color raised upon the surface. And from the red, blue, or yellow gloom of the throat emerged a straight bar, rough with gold dust and slightly clubbed at the end. The petals were voluminous enough to be stirred by the summer breeze, and when they moved, the red, blue, and yellow lights passed one over the other, staining an inch of the brown earth beneath with a spot of the most intricate color. The light fell either upon the smooth gray back of a pebble, or the shell of a snail with its brown circular veins, or falling into a raindrop, it expanded with such intensity of red, blue, and yellow the thin walls of water that one expected them to burst and disappear. Instead, the drop was left in a second silver gray once more, and the light now settled upon the flesh of a leaf, revealing the branching thread of fiber beneath the surface. And again it moved on and spread its illumination in the vast green spaces beneath the dome of the heart-shaped and tongue-shaped leaves. Then the breeze stirred rather more briskly overhead, and the color was flashed into the air above, into the eyes of the men and women who walk in Kew Gardens in July. The figures of these men and women straggled past the flower bed with a curiously irregular movement, not unlike that of the white and blue butterflies who crossed the turf in zigzag flights from bed to bed. The man was about 6 inches in front of the woman, strolling carelessly, while she bore on with greater purpose, only turning her head now and then to see that the children were not too far behind. The man kept this distance in front of the woman purposely, though perhaps unconsciously, for he wished to go on with his thoughts. 15 years ago I came here with Lily, he thought. We sat somewhere over there by a lake, and I begged her to marry me all through the hot afternoon. How the dragonfly kept circling round us, how clearly I see the dragonfly in her shoe with the square silver buckle at the toe. All the time I spoke, I saw her shoe, and when it moved impatiently, I knew without looking up what she was going to say. The whole of her seemed to be in her shoe. And my love, my desire were in the dragonfly. For some reason, I thought that if it settled there, on that leaf, the broad one with the red flower in the middle of it, if the dragonfly settled on the leaf, she would say yes at once. But the dragonfly went round and round. It never settled anywhere. Of course not. Happily not, or I shouldn't be walking here with Eleanor and the children. Tell me, Eleanor, do you ever think of the past? Why do you ask, Simon? Because I've been thinking of the past. I've been thinking of Lily, the woman I might have married. Well, why are you silent? Do you mind my thinking of the past? Why should I mind, Simon? Doesn't one always think of the past in a garden with men and women lying under the trees? Aren't they one's past, all that remains of it, those men and women, those ghosts lying under the trees? One's happiness, one's reality? For me, a square silver shoe buckle and a dragonfly. For me, a kiss. Imagine 6 little girls sitting before their easels 20 years ago, down by the side of a lake, painting the water lilies, the first red water lilies I'd ever seen. And suddenly a kiss, there on the back of my neck, and my hand shook all the afternoon so that I couldn't paint. I took out my watch and marked the hour when I would allow myself to think of the kiss for 5 minutes only. It was so precious. The kiss of an old gray-haired woman with a wart on her nose, the mother of all my kisses all my life. Come, Caroline. Come, Hubert. They walked on past the flower bed, now walking 4 abreast, and soon diminished in size among the trees and looked half transparent as the sunlight and shade swam over their backs in large, trembling, irregular patches. In the oval flower bed, the snail, whose shell had been stained red, blue, and yellow for the space of 2 minutes or so, now appeared to be moving very slightly in its shell, and next began to labor over the crumbs of loose earth, which broke away and rolled down as it passed over them. It appeared to have a definite goal in front of it, differing in this respect from the singular, high-stepping, angular green insect who attempted to cross in front of it, and waited for a second, with its antenna trembling as if in deliberation, and then stepped off as rapidly and strangely in the opposite direction. Brown cliffs with deep green lakes in the hollows, flat, blade-like trees that waved from root to tip, round boulders of gray stone, vast crumpled surfaces of a thin, crackling texture. All these objects lay across the snail's progress between one stalk and another to his goal. Before he had decided whether to circumvent the arched tent of a dead leaf or to breast it, there came past the bed the feet of other human beings. This time they were both men. The younger of the two wore an expression of perhaps unnatural calm. He raised his eyes and fixed them very steadily in front of him while his companion spoke. And directly his companion had done speaking, he looked on the ground again and sometimes opened his lips only after a long pause, and sometimes did not open them at all. The elder man had a curiously uneven and shaky method of walking, jerking his hand forward and throwing up his head abruptly, rather in the manner of an impatient carriage horse, tired of waiting outside a house. But in the man these gestures were irresolute and pointless. He talked almost incessantly. He smiled to himself and again began to talk, as if the smile had been an answer. He was talking about spirits, the spirits of the dead, who, according to him, were even now telling him all sorts of odd things about their experiences in heaven. Heaven was known to the ancients as Thessaly, went William, and now, with this war, the spirit matter is rolling between the hills like thunder. He paused, seemed to listen, smiled, jerked his head, and continued. You have a small electric battery and a piece of rubber to insulate the wire. Isolate? Insulate? Well, we'll skip the details. No good going into details that wouldn't be understood. And in short, the little machine stands in any convenient position by the head of the bed, we will say, on a neat mahogany stand. All arrangements being properly fixed by workmen under my direction, the widow applies her ear and summons the spirit by sign, as agreed. Women, widows, women in black. Here he seemed to have caught sight of a woman's dress in the distance, which in the shade looked a purple black. He took off his hat, placed his hand upon his heart, and hurried towards her, muttering and gesticulating feverishly. But William caught him by the sleeve and touched a flower with the tip of his walking stick in order to divert the old man's attention. After looking at it for a moment in some confusion, the old man bent his ear to it and seemed to answer a voice speaking from it, for he began talking about the forests of Uruguay, which he had visited hundreds of years ago, in company with the most beautiful young woman in Europe. He could be heard murmuring about forests of Uruguay, blanketed with the wax petals of tropical roses, nightingales, sea beaches, mermaids, and women drowned at sea, as he suffered himself to be moved on by William, upon whose face the look of stoical patience grew slowly deeper and deeper. Following his steps so closely as to be slightly puzzled by his gestures, came two elderly women of the lower middle class, one stout and ponderous, the other rosy-cheeked and nimble. Like most people of their station, they were frankly fascinated by any signs of eccentricity betokening a disordered brain, especially in the well-to-do, but they were too far off to be certain whether the gestures were merely eccentric or genuinely mad. After they had scrutinized the old man's back in silence for a moment and given each other a queer, sly look, they went on energetically piecing together their very complicated dialogue. Nell, Bert, Lot, Sess, Phil, Pa, he says, I says, she says, I says, I says, I says. My Bert, Sis, Bill, Grandad, the old man, sugar, sugar, flour, kippers, greens, sugar, sugar, sugar. The ponderous woman looked through the pattern of falling words at the flowers standing cool, firm, and upright in the earth with a curious expression. She saw them as a sleeper waking from a heavy sleep sees a brass candlestick reflecting the light in an unfamiliar way, and closes his eyes and opens them, and seeing the brass candlestick again, finally starts broad awake and stares at the candlestick with all his powers. So the heavy woman came to a standstill opposite the oval-shaped flower bed and ceased even to pretend to listen to what the other woman was saying. She stood there letting the words fall over her, swaying the top part of her body slowly backwards and forwards, looking at the flowers. Then she suggested that they should find a seat and have their tea. The snail had now considered every possible method of reaching his goal without going round the dead leaf or climbing over it. Let alone the effort needed for climbing a leaf, he was doubtful whether the thin texture which vibrated with such an alarming crackle when touched even by the tip of his horns would bear his weight, and this determined him finally to creep beneath it, for there was a point where the leaf curved high enough from the ground to admit him. He had just inserted his head in the opening and was taking stock of the high brown roof and was getting used to the cool brown light, when two other people came past outside on the turf. This time they were both young, a young man and a young woman. They were both in the prime of youth, or even in that season which precedes the prime of youth, the season before the smooth pink folds of the flower have burst their gummy case, when the wings of the butterfly, though fully grown, are motionless in the sun. Lucky it isn't Friday, he observed. Why? Do you believe in luck? They make you pay sixpence on Friday. What's sixpence anyway? Isn't it worth sixpence?
What's it? What do you mean by it? Oh, anything. I mean, you know what I mean. Long pauses came between each of these remarks. They were uttered in toneless and monotonous voices. The couple stood still on the edge of the flower bed and together pressed the end of her parasol deep down into the soft earth. The action, and the fact that his hand rested on the top of hers, expressed their feelings in a strange way, as these short, insignificant words also expressed something. Words with short wings for their heavy body of meaning, inadequate to carry them far, and thus alighting awkwardly upon the very common objects that surrounded them, and were to their inexperienced touch so massive. But who knows, so they thought as they pressed the parasol into the earth, what precipices aren't concealed in them, or what slopes of ice don't shine in the sun on the other side. Who knows? Who has ever seen this before? Even when she wondered what sort of tea they gave you at Kew, he felt that something loomed up behind her words and stood vast and solid behind them, and the mist very slowly rose and uncovered. Oh, heavens, what were those shapes? Little white tables and waitresses who looked first at her and then at him. And there was a bill that he would pay with a real 2-shilling piece, and it was real, all real, he assured himself, fingering the coin in his pocket. Real to everyone except to him and to her. Even to him it began to seem real. And then, but it was too exciting to stand and think any longer, and he pulled the parasol out of the earth with a jerk and was impatient to find the place where one had tea with other people, like other people. Come along, Trissy. It's time we had our tea. Wherever does one have one's tea? She asked with the oddest thrill of excitement in her voice, looking vaguely round and letting herself be drawn on down the grass path, trailing her parasol, turning her head this way and that way, forgetting her tea, wishing to go down there and then down there, remembering orchids and cranes among wild flowers, a Chinese pagoda, and a crimson-crested bird. But he bore her on. Thus, one couple after another, with much the same irregular and aimless movement, passed the flower bed and were enveloped in layer after layer of green-blue vapor, in which at first their bodies had substance and a dash of color, but later both substance and color dissolved in the green-blue atmosphere. How hot it was! So hot that even the thrush chose to hop, like a mechanical bird in the shadow of the flowers, with long pauses between one movement and the next. Instead of rambling vaguely, the white butterflies danced one above another, making with their white shifting flakes the outline of a shattered marble column above the tallest flowers. The glass roofs of the palm house shone as if a whole market full of shiny green umbrellas had opened in the sun. And in the drone of the aeroplane, the voice of the summer sky murmured its fierce soul. Yellow and black, pink and snow white, shapes of all these colors, men, women, and children were spotted for a second upon the horizon, and then, seeing the breadth of yellow that lay upon the grass, they wavered and sought shade beneath the trees, dissolving like drops of water in the yellow and green atmosphere, staining it faintly with red and blue. It seemed as if all gross and heavy bodies had sunk down in the heat, motionless, and lay huddled upon the ground. But their voices went wavering from them as if they were flames lolling from the thick waxen bodies of candles. Voices. Yes, voices. Wordless voices, breaking the silence suddenly with such depth of contentment, such passion of desire, or, in the voices of children, such freshness of surprise. Breaking the silence. But there was no silence. All the time the motor omnibuses were turning their wheels and changing their gear, like a vast nest of Chinese boxes, all of wrought steel, turning ceaselessly, one within another, the city murmured, on the top of which the voices cried aloud, and the petals of myriads of flowers flashed their colors into the air. Okay, that was Kew Gardens, written by Virginia Woolf and published by the Hogarth Press, with Virginia and Leonard as the publishers, and both Virginia and the press are now on their way. The story was like an impressionist painting. It has that drift I referred to, a drift through the gardens and a snail marching along with intention. The second story in a row we've had featuring a snail. Maybe a snail was like Virginia's Madeleine. Not the cookie-like qualities, but similar in their ability to inspire some deep contemplative thought. And it was a landmark in Virginia Woolf's development. Leonard said that Kew Gardens contained all her previously unwritten novels to date. And it's often viewed as the text in Woolf's development as a fiction writer, testing the limits of and expanding the form. The story is experimental, taking multiple perspectives, a post-impressionistic kind of style, putting into words what others were doing with paint, focused on the recording of the light and colors and impressions of the world in prose adequate for the task. It's sensuous and lyrical, a snail moving along like a person, but the flowers are like people too, with throats and flesh and leaves like hearts and tongues. The movement between people and animals, between humans and the world, and the objects of their contemplation, sometimes noticed, sometimes not, was groundbreaking. "It's amazing how good this story about four stupid people is," said one critic. I'm paraphrasing that. "It shows what depths there are beneath the surface." Kew Gardens got a rave review in the Times Literary Supplement, and the Woolfs and their press would never be the same. Here's a quote from the review. Quote, "Here is Kew Gardens, a work of art made, created, as we say, finished, four square, a thing of original and therefore strange beauty, with its own atmosphere, its own vital force. Quotation cannot present its beauty, or as we should like to say, its being. Perhaps the beginning might be suppler, but the more one gloats over Kew Gardens, the more beauty shines out of it. And the fitter to it seems this cover that is like no other cover and carries associations, and the more one likes Mrs. Bell's Kew Gardens woodcuts." End quote. Note there that the critic is saying not just that the story is a good one, but that the object of a book, the book published by the Hogarth Press, which included cover illustrations from Vanessa Bell, was worth having, was beautiful in and of itself. An object that one wanted to hold in one's hand and regard its beauty. It's a beautiful thing to say of a book. And so the orders flooded in. Flood is a bit funny to use as a word. Remember, we're on a smaller scale now. Before the review came out, they had sold 49 copies of the book. After the review, they sold out the rest of the first 150 copies that they had printed, but they still had orders for another 500, thanks to the review. So they took the story to a commercial printer for help. As Leonard later wrote, quote, "In 1918, we printed two small books, Poems by T.S. Eliot and Kew Gardens by Virginia. Of Kew Gardens, we printed about 170 copies. The total sold of the first edition was 148. We published it on 12 May 1919 at 2 shillings. When we started printing and publishing with our publication number one, we did not send out any review copies, but in the case of Prelude, Tom's Poems, and Kew Gardens, we sent review copies to the Times Literary Supplement. By 31 May, we had sold 49 copies of Kew Gardens. On Tuesday, May 27th, we went to Asham and stayed there for a week, returning to Richmond on June 3rd. In the previous week, a review of Kew Gardens had appeared in the Literary Supplement, giving it tremendous praise. When we opened the door of Hogarth House, we found the hall covered with envelopes and postcards containing orders from booksellers all over the country. It was impossible for us to start printing enough copies to meet these orders, so we went to a printer, Richard Madeley, and got him to print a second edition of 500 copies, which cost us £8, 9 shillings, and 6 pence. It was sold by the end of 1920. Remember, we told you that the printing press that the Woolfs owned made copies one page at a time. It was beautiful and freeing for an artist, but not exactly lickety-split. In the bigger scheme of things, Richard Madeley, the printer they used, was lickety-splittier. and they would use such lickety-splittier types for big jobs from then on. They still had not published a full-blown book, a full-length book. These were more like pamphlets. Their first big books would be Virginia's short story collection, Monday or Tuesday, which they printed in 1,000 copies with woodcuts by Vanessa Bell again, and then Virginia's novel Jacob's Room, which came out in 1922. The Wasteland would soon follow, and the Hogarth Press was firmly established. Over the next 15 or so years, they published many successful books by Virginia and others, as we talked about a bit in our last episode. Soon, they would be up to publishing 30 or 40 titles a year. Those first few years, they had one or two, sometimes five. Virginia gave up her share of the business in 1938. Leonard Wolfe took on an employee, John Lehman, as a partner for the next 8 years or so, but the two could not agree on much, so finally Leonard bought him out and sold his share to another publishing house. Hogarth Press still continued publishing The Complete Works of Freud, a famous work by Jacques Lacan, and much more fiction and poetry. Today, it still exists as, quote, an adventurous fiction imprint with an accent on the pleasures of storytelling and a broad awareness of the world, end quote. The description they give of themselves is one that I've revolved around in my mind. Thinking through, it seems to fit Virginia, the press's founder. Hardly anyone devoted more of her life to books and the stories within them more than she did, and very few people have had her broad awareness of the world. And yet, in a way, she doesn't fit that description very well either. Pleasures of storytelling sounds like a Robert Louis Stevenson, perhaps, and Wolfe's works are much less accessible than that. It's pleasure of a different kind. Less action, more reflection. Less firecracker plot, more observation and quiet movements. And for that matter, we see a difference in what we might mean by broad awareness of the world. It's not the newspaper headlines and political developments, and yet it's not exactly a cloistered view either. It's more like the world and its current state as it makes an impression on the inward consciousness. It's what it means to be a thinking person, a deeply thinking person, right here and right now, in our time and at no other. If these writers shared the themes of modernism, it's because it reflected what the world was going through, and they were sensitive to it. It's the airplane overhead, breaking the silence of a sky that had been without airplanes for millions of years, breaking that silence with the fierceness of its soul and the sounds and the colors of the world rotating their way to the top and bursting forth in full bloom. It's an inward kind of event, perhaps, and our position regarding the events in the story is one of being drawn into a deep interior. But it's not disconnected from the world either. It's not a world of surfaces. It's a world of depth. It's not a painting that's flat and hangs on a museum wall. It's a painting that turns out to be a cover that opens with pages that live within. Okay. That's going to do it for this episode of The History of Literature. I'm glad you were here today. My thanks to Virginia Woolf and Leonard, too. A little cameo for him, helping to make the Hogarth Press what it was. Lots of good books they published, and the sustaining and inspiring impact that the press had on the works of Virginia Woolf. The works and the artistry, which continue to sustain and inspire, as millions of readers around the world can attest. It can be a little hard to see Virginia Woolf's works as groundbreaking now to gauge the impact that they had on first publication, but that's because she's been so influential. We've absorbed her the way we've absorbed Flaubert and Chekhov and Kafka and Joyce and Samuel Beckett. Speaking of absorption, it's time to go. Well, that's not much of a link, is it? But we're not all geniuses. Some of us are more snail-like, which... hey, there's some nobility to that, as we were reminded today. Some noble beauty in all creation is part of being on the planet, or being anywhere, really. There's noble beauty in space, too. Maybe we can look up once in a while to appreciate it. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.